Welcome back to another episode of Off the Shelf on the Fleming Foundation. I'm your host, Stephen Heiner, and with me, as always, is Dr. Thomas Fleming. Hello, Dr. Fleming.
Hello, Stephen.
Today, we're going to do a bit of shameless plugging, if you don't mind, dear listeners, and dare I say, Dr. Fleming, because I don't think Dr. Fleming toots his horn enough, and nothing like a half Asian to help you toot that horn a little bit more, Dr. Fleming. Yeah. Today, the horn that we'll be tooting in particular is 1,000 Years of Jihad, which by the time our listeners will listen to this podcast will have been out for several weeks on our website, both in paperback form, as well as we're up to date, Dr. Fleming. We've got this digital PDF download available for our listeners. Aren't we advanced?
Before long, we'll discover the internet.
Yeah. I want to begin at the beginning, Dr. Fleming, with the introduction. Before the recording, you had said that you thought your original introduction was a little too rude, and so you cleaned it up for our readers. Can you tell us a bit about what your introduction was hoping to accomplish?
Well, one of the problems in America is Americans are allergic to frank speech. They've always been allergic to frank speech. Everybody complains about the 60s or political correctness. Political correctness in the United States goes back to the founding. Alexis de Tocqueville complained that you can't talk to anything in America because they're too divided, you know, on religion and principle and philosophy. So they talk about the weather. Today we talk about sports and TV. So to talk honestly about the conflict between Islam and the West requires a kind of mental effort that we Americans don't like to make. We have to admit there are people in the world who hate us today, they hated us last year, they hated us 1,000 years ago, and that we can't just all get along, to use Rodney King's famous request, because we're on opposite sides of the fence. And it doesn't mean that Muslims are all bad people. I have known any number of very fine Muslims. And it doesn't mean that all Christians are good people. Most Christians I've known have not been good people.
I would have been very surprised if you were going to say some of my best friends are Muslims.
No, you can't be best friends with me. Now, the worse the Muslim, the better the friend. That is, a good Christian in America would believe in the Holy Trinity and go to church regularly. We always say in America, the church of his choice. He is free to attend, except he can't do it now. However, you know, he draws the line at certain places. Like, he knows that Mormons and Unitarians aren't Christians, and he knows that Muslims belong to an enemy religion. But a bad Christian, you know, gets along with everybody, and a bad Muslim can get along with Christians because he doesn't believe much of anything. I met a lot of very nice sort of wishy-washy Muslims in Turkey. They hankered after the days of their grandparents, where people actually believed in Islam, and some of them, I think, are in the process of reverting. But the trouble is, when they wake up and they realize, you know, some kid who's been brought up secular and he discovers the truth and glory of the preaching of Muhammad, well, then he becomes a jihadist and he has to kill us. So we, at least as Christians, if we wake up and realize the reality of the Christian faith and the Christian tradition, we realize we have to resist our enemies, but we don't have to commit genocide.
Indeed. No, the worst that might happen is more fasting and some weight that we could lose, Dr. Fleming.
Yes, exactly. Well, speak for yourself.
I think that one of the interesting points you touch on in the introduction, and it runs through several of the essays in this volume, is this idea that it's not a clean and neat situation where the Muslims are the baddies and the Christians are the goodies, that very often the Christians manage to make it quite easy for the Muslims to make their way to Belgrade and beyond.
Yes. Well, you know, the old famous joke about Lenin was going to destroy capitalism, and how will we do that, Comrade Lenin? I mean, they have all these resources. And he said, well, we'll hang them with their own rope. Well, where will we get their money? Well, they'll lend it to us, you know. So we have been in the process of subsidizing Islam from almost the beginning. And, you know, there were dissident Christians. There's an argument now over that whether this is true or not, but it was felt that Monophysite and Monothelite Christians in Egypt and the Middle East were more easily seduced by Islam, first of all, because it comes up with a theology that's closer to their own, and second of all, because they were very mad at the government of the Eastern Empire Empire for favoring Orthodox Christianity over their own heresy. Ever since that, during any kind of European conflict, let's say France against the Austro-Hungarian Empire, then the French, for example, will be selling arms, giving access, sending mercenaries to the Turkish Empire. And even as we speak today, there's one great power in the world that has been fomenting Islamic revolution everywhere, and that is the government of the United States. We did everything we could to encourage, it's a very long story and I'm not going to tell it, the Bosnian terrorist uprising during the breakup of Yugoslavia, the Islamic Albanian terrorists in Kosovo. We have done everything to encourage the Kurds, who are extreme Islamic terrorists in the Middle East, and the Chechens in this former Soviet Union. So everywhere you look where there is Islamic anti-Christian terrorism and aggression, the United States, the CIA, and the Pentagon are in there giving them weapons, giving them encouragement, telling them, don't give up, keep on killing the Christians.
The very first essay in our collection is from Dr. Brownlow and is titled Byron Among the Turks. And I was fascinated by this, Dr. Fleming, in part because I do like some of Lord Byron's poetry, not most of it, but some of it. And the way that Dr. Brownlow tells the story is so engaging, as anyone who's ever had a chance to listen to Dr. Brownlow give a talk or lead a class. He always manages to weave in great storytelling with interesting facts. And I wanted to know what your reaction was when you first came across this, Dr. Fleming.
Well, I've been very interested in Byron's activities as a Greek patriot. His life among the Turks and his life hanging out with Muslims, you know, it's a very interesting and gaudy chapter of the great poet's life. And he is, in an odd way, he is one of those great-souled poets. He had petty sides, he had childish behavior. But, you know, in his last years during the Greek Revolution, he was reserved. He never tried to play the Byronic role. And he was courteous and quiet. He raised money. He was the voice of reason in the councils of the brigands and pirates who were making up much of the Greek leadership. So his experiences in the East, which of course have so much to do with writing of Don Juan and his other narrative works. Anyway, yes, I agree entirely. It's a wonderful story.
I think most of us who don't know the history as you do tend to think about that world that Byron explored and inhabited in the shape more or less that it's taken today, where we have these balkanized, literally balkanized nation states. But at the time that Byron was visiting, it was really still a shifting mass. You could even argue today, maybe it still is, a shifting mass of loyalties and arms. And reading Dr. Brownlow's essay, I thought, really brought that to light and, again, gave us a lens with which to view this long-running conflict, which really goes back to the First Crusade.
Yes. Well, what's something I didn't mention in an earlier answer is that another area in which the United States and its NATO allies has been extremely pro-Muslim is that we very one-sidedly have backed the Turks in every conflict with the Greeks. And so it used to be a point of pride for the British and for Western man in general that the descendants of the people who created our civilization, that is the Greeks, that they should be defended and protected from the Ottoman Empire, which had conquered them in the course of the 14th and 15th century, subjugated, exploited, and then in the early 20th century, of course, massacred them along the coast of Asia Minor and the offshore islands there. The Greek massacre of the Armenians is somewhat known to Americans, but at the same time as the Turks were massacring Armenians, they were doing the same thing to Greek Christians and Jews along the coast. The massacre at Smyrna was particularly gruesome. Smyrna, now known as Izmir, none of this seems to be known to Americans. And during the Balkan Wars, during the breakup of Yugoslavia back in the 1990s, it was as if you couldn't talk to people. Bill Clinton seemed not to know that the Balkans were different from the Baltic countries. Here he is making policy on these questions. Ignorance really is not bliss when it comes to foreign policy.
Well, certainly not bliss for the Christians in that part of the world. The next essay in the book, Dr. Fleming, is one of yours, called Cowboys and Muslims, the subtitle John Smith on the Ottoman Frontier. Now, I don't want to spoil the pleasure for our listeners of reading the text, so I think I'll simply lead with the idea that most of us don't realize that John Smith, long before he came to America, had an interesting, you could say, crusading history.
Yes, John Smith is really the great symbolic founder of America. He ends up leading the first real colony, the Jamestown colony. But he was a great adventurer. He had always longed to sort of join in some great crusade. He had studied military science very carefully, and he had learned a lot about cavalry from the riding master to the Earl of Lincoln, who was in fact a descendant of the Palaeologus emperors of Constantinople, that is, of the Eastern Roman Empire. So Smith engaged in a very brilliant and strange career that took him through parts of Croatia and Hungary in fighting Turks. Finally, by the count in charge of the expedition for the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Count Modrush, he was made a gentleman and give it a coat of arms, which consisted of three Turks' heads, because he had in successive single combats killed three large, violent Turkish warriors who accepted his challenge. John Smith is the spiritual father of people like Daniel Boone and Wyatt Earp and Jim Bowie, these strange, violent men that we Americans have adored for so long and until we got terrified of submicroscopic particles. This career is what prepared him to exert leadership. It's first of all why he was, why he went along to the New World, why he took the job. He was an effective commander at Jamestown because of his long experience in fighting the equally savage Turk. Smith wrote a lot of books. He wrote Account of the Founding of Virginia. He wrote his own autobiography. They are really among, well, maybe they are the first American books worth reading because he is our hero. And so after the war between the states, Henry Adams, a descendant of the Yankee Adams family, decided his first major essay would be an attack on the credibility of John Smith, because we had to undermine this hero of Virginia if we wanted to undermine the Southern ethic. But unfortunately, it was also the American ethic. A lot of what makes us American is precisely this extravagant quality of independence and resolution and courage that Smith displayed. He had his head very straight on the importance of rescuing European Christendom from the Ottoman yoke.
Following this is a set of two essays called The Barbary Corsairs, Part 1, The Scourge of the Mediterranean, and Part 2, The Solution, also by Dr. Brownlow. In our American history classes, Dr. Fleming, we're not often likely to hear about the Barbary Wars, even though it's memorialized in the Marine Corps hymn, The Shores of Tripoli. We're not likely to hear it in our American history classes. And so it was wonderful for Dr. Brownlow to not only walk people through the various inept possibilities that were launched by different presidents, but also the reality that piracy by Muslims is not something that has ever changed. It was there at the beginning, it was there at the time of the Barbary Wars, and it will be with us at the end of time.
Yes, well, people think that the Somali pirates come out of nowhere. By the way, we're rarely even informed that a lot of these Somalis are Muslim. Piracy is not just a piracy to gain money, although it is usually that's perhaps the primary motive, but it's also a form of terrorism. President Barack Obama once famously said that of Islam, that it was with us as Americans from the beginning. Well, it was. But that is, Muslim terrorism and piracy is one of the first problems that American presidents had to combat. And, you know, Jefferson was the least warlike of our presidents, and he really sort of gutted the Navy. He believed that America could be defended. We didn't need a real Navy. We needed little gunboats and things. And Jefferson tried to sort of ease his way out of facing up to the Barbary pirates. But the Congress of the United States, as well as the political leadership in the United States, eventually including Jefferson himself, understood that we could not simply pay ransom and blood money to these North African Muslims. We had to resist. Everyone else in Europe just paid them off. It was seemed to be more convenient, although the Brits also did have violent conflict with them. And that part of the world has always been a place for rogue states and rogue leaders to operate. And the more the U.S., of course, gets involved, we support the worst rogues. In other words, when these guys get old, like Gaddafi, they start worrying, and so they quit sponsoring terrorism. They begin to realize they have to get along with the world's only remaining superpower. So what do? We knock Gaddafi off, the brilliant move of Madam Clinton and Obama. And so the result is we get all of North Africa destabilized. Tourists are smart if they don't go there. And we basically back the radical Islamic alternative to stable despotic military regimes, which is what we did in Egypt. Fortunately, the Egyptian army, as was predicted from the beginning, just let the thing get out of control in Egypt long enough for them to be called back to power. And now they're firmly in the saddle. Thank goodness.
I think your point's well made, Dr. Fleming. The seeds of Benghazi were sown back during the times of these wars as well. Bungling and an inability to realize the situation for what it is. This is not a political inconvenience. This is a way of life for these people.
Yeah, exactly.
That way of life continues on in the next essay that follows this, also by Dr. Brownlow, on the Song of Roland. I think an underappreciated classic that needs to be read usually by college students, but sometimes by some interested and engaged high school students. Dr. Fleming, Song of Roland is not well known among my French contemporaries. When I talk to them about it, they're somewhat aloof or confused when I refer to it. Do you think this is also the case among our American friends?
Yeah, well, I think even the French in the state of French education, which has fallen so precipitously in the past 30 or 40 years, even they have some idea of what the Song of Roland is about. In America, there's really no knowledge. There's no knowledge of it as a great work of literature. And of course, by the way, in our own history, it's interesting to note our own history going back to 1066 and beyond in England, that as the Normans advanced at the Battle of Hastings, they had troubadours or jongleurs reciting passages of the Song of Roland to inspire them because, you know, the Pope had given his blessing to this Norman raid on Anglo-Saxon England. It was among the more despicable things done by the papacy, although nothing, of course, can stand up to the things being done, even as we are doing this podcast. This is an important part of history. The family of Charlemagne came to power partly because of their competence, and Charles Martel, his grandfather, an illegitimate son of his family, but Charles Martel had successfully warded off attacks from Muslim-controlled Spain into France and had driven them back. Now, it's often thought that after the Battle of Poitiers, or the Battle of Tours, as it's sometimes called, that somehow the Muslims disappeared. That's not true at all. The Muslims were well entrenched throughout Provence, and they had large territories they were still holding in the south of France. They controlled the passes into the Alps. They had robber baron nests up there, as they did in southern Italy. It was an authentic and genuine threat. the Chanson de Roland is about as historically valid as parts of Homer are. It's based on real historical memory, but of course, everything but the names are changed to protect the innocent as well as the guilty. What it preserves is this sense of what it was like to be in the empire of Charlemagne, to be finding your identity as European Catholics and being threatened, seriously threatened by an uprising of Islamic strength in North Africa and Spain. And that was by no means a foregone conclusion that France would be kept out of the Muslim clutches any more than it was a foregone conclusion that Italy would survive the Islamic attacks. And so it took extremely resolute men like Charles Martel, his son Pippin the Short, and grandson Charles the Great, Charlemagne.
Well, you come on to the next essay, Dr. Fleming, which you had the first word. It's also the last word. And as I was reading this, for anyone who's had a chance to hear you hold forth on these matters, I actually thought this was quite restrained, as it was probably one-fifth of what you actually know on the topic. So I thought the essay was probably an exercise in restraint and editing more than anything else for you, because this is a topic that you know very well. And it's about the various parts of Italy that had to deal with various waves of Muslim, shall we say, today it's immigration, isn't it, Dr. Fleming?
Yes, that's right.
But back then it was invasion, and everyone called it that.
They were seeking labor. They were seeking new jobs and a chance to breathe the free air of the West.
They wanted to do jobs that peasants weren't willing to do themselves.
Precisely. The history of some of the greatest states or city-states in Italy is bound up with their success in fighting Islam. On the west coast of Italy, of course, we get Pisa and Genoa, and they were engaged in a terrible struggle with both Islamic national powers in North Africa and in eastern Spain and on the islands, you know, Mallorca, Menorca. Pisa's strength and power, Pisa at one point was a great world power, came precisely from driving the Muslims out of that part of the Mediterranean. Because Muslim fleets sailed up the Arno River and burned most of Pisa on one occasion. It was not simply one-sided Pisan aggression against harmless Muslims. On the contrary, they were fighting for their existence. And what it tells you about great men of Pisa, who again share the spirit of Charles Martel and John Smith. These were resolute warriors. These were not just canny merchants such as we find in Florence. When they finally did their great raid on the North African pirate states, anticipating by hundreds of years what went on with the British and the Americans in North Africa, they wiped out some of these robber states, and they took tremendous spoils. And what the Pisans did is they had an unfinished cathedral which needed a facade, and so they devoted the larger part of the spoils to building the beautiful facciata on the face of the one of the greatest cathedrals in the world. So the story of Pisa is and Genoa are intimately bound up. They liberated Sardinia, Italy, from Muslim conquest. But the story of Venice is intimately bound up with Venetian resistance to Ottoman aggression on the other side of the Mediterranean. And at least we know something about the Battle of Lepanto and that story of Venice and the papacy joining up with the Spanish and Austrian Empire. However, nobody seems to realize is that Mehmed the Great, Mehmed the Conqueror, who had conquered Constantinople, cherished all his life the ambition to conquer Rome. Some degenerate Italian humanist intellectuals, anti-Catholic as so many of them were, encouraged him in the fantasy that as the ruler of Constantinople, he was now the Roman emperor, and therefore he had a right to rule Italy. And Mehmed took this quite seriously, trying to get out through the northern route, which is why they had to take Belgrade and why they wanted to get Budapest, because that would then expose northern Italy to invasion. It was a key part of the plan. So eventually he lands troops in Bari And it's the local sort of Lombard Italian nobility that is largely responsible for the resistance. Fortunately for the fate of Rome and the fate of Christianity, Mehmed dies during the, and then the will to fight this war, which the Christians have shown a very surprising resistance. South Italians in those days were not the most resolute, tough people in Europe, but there was surprising resistance to the Ottoman invasion, and that was the last serious attempt, by no means the first, but the last serious attempt for Islamic occupation of Italy until the recent wave of migrants coming in little boats from North Africa.
I reminded Dr. Fleming your allusion to the deranged intellectuals who wanted to give a seat at the table to the putative head of Constantinople. They have their intellectual descendants today in the people who want Turkey to join the European Union.
Yes. A funny thing, if Turkey did join the European Union, and Erdogan understands this thoroughly, he's one of the most clever politicians in the world today, he would be subject, as crummy as the EU is, and as lax as they are in enforcing rules, his human rights record is sort of on par with Pol Pot in Cambodia. And if you know anything about what it would be like to be a Christian living in Constantinople or in Turkey in general, they have absolutely no rights. The Turkish constitution gives them all rights, but they're all taken away in practice. Erdogan would be hamstrung and would be probably overthrown by the members of his own Islamist party if he joined the EU. And so he's playing this double game. He pretends to be shocked and horrified that he's not let in. I mean, Turkey has been a part of civilized Europe from the beginning. And, of course, the irony is if you meet Turks from Istanbul, you meet educated Turks. First of all, they're 95% European ethnically. They're not Turks at all. The Turkish ruling class consistently married Christian white Europeans. And so it's like two different races.
Yeah, I think it was said that Mehmet's mother was a Christian, I think.
Perhaps an Italian Jewish, certainly an Italian, because okay. she had a strange name like Rachel, which was very unusual. But nobody knows. His German biographer speculates she's Jewish. His father, Murad II, had a Christian mother. Well, what about his father? Christian mother. What about his father? Christian mother. Mehmed the Conqueror is 90% non-Turkish. So they married Georgians, Circassians, Serbs, Greeks, Italians, and of course they took many wives. It's the number one wife who is usually the mother of the heir. And those heirs, generation after generation after generation, and of course their descendants made up the aristocratic class in Istanbul in the 18th, 19th century. Those are European people. And so it's very easy to get misled because they're nice, they're polite, they're well-behaved, they're very westernized. Then I am told by people who have made the mistake of traveling in central Anatolia, things ain't the same there. Turkey really is two countries. The ruling class, until Erdogan came to power, the ruling class was very suspicious of Islam. It thought it was, they looked upon it as a problem.
And I think for our listeners, this volume should give to you at least one way that you might react to it is the way that I did, which is as a wonderful appetizer to get more deep into the history of Italy, the more into what I took it as was a push towards a greater knowledge of the Crusades, because really, in a sense, the Crusades are a prequel to a lot of the essays that are in this volume. But Dr. Fleming, to end our episode on the same note that I began it, this sort of shameless promotion, once they've done reading this volume, contact us here at the Foundation to ask about a bulk discount. I think this would be wonderful to give out in packs of four or five to people who you know, because one, it's not very long. Dr. Fleming, I think it weighs in at just about 120, 130 pages.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, it's not a lot.
It's not technical either. It's readable and entertaining.
And the essays are not connected insofar as you don't need to read one in order to understand the other. You could read Dr. Fleming's John Smith on its own, and you can invite people to read. It don't have to feel like you need to read the whole thing all the way through. Read something where the title catches your eye and get in there, and it's not, even that essay will not be very long. So might I encourage our listeners to contact us for some possible bulk discounts, Dr. Fleming?
Absolutely.
And for those who are interested in digital forms, obviously we have digital copies as well. So whatever format you'd like to make available to your friends and spread the word, not just about the real story about Islam, but of our work here at the Fleming Foundation, because this book is the first of many that Dr. Fleming hopes to put out there in the years to come, which is a collection, a sort of tasting menu of some of the ideas, some of the important things that we'd like to talk about, and a way to get out there. As we know, on the internet, there are so many things that compete for attention, but a book still remains. And it's an important way that we want to choose to communicate, not just with you, our supporters and our listeners, but with the outside world, because they need the message of the Fleming Foundation as well. Dr. Fleming, any last words to end our shameless promotion?
My last word is goodbye.
Thank you, as always, for your time.
This was a presentation of the Fleming Foundation.